Today is June 28th, 2020. This is a part 13 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Good, Tom. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
You got my permission to use this.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Just to clarify that, may we have your permission to use this recording over the phone?
Well, yeah. Well, I think I just said that.
You did. Thank you very much. Here, you're training me well. This is good. At the end of part 13, you'd mentioned that you got to the point where Dick Marks really trusted you, and you're kind of getting your feet there at Grand Canyon. One of the people you mentioned a couple times is a fellow named Ernie Kuncel. And how do you spell Ernie's last name?
K-U-N-C-L.
And Ernie, was that short for Ernest?
Ernest.
Okay. K-U-N-C-I-L.
No, there's no I.
K-U-N-C-L. K-U-N-C-L.
Yes.
Okay, and where was he from? That's an interesting last name.
So, I mean, I actually have a thing that I could read, but to answer your question, he's from Chicago.
I wonder what his heritage is. It's just an interesting last name.
Well, he's like Eastern European.
Okay. Okay. I don't know whether it would be good for you to read to us or for you to just relate.
Yeah, okay.
Was Ernie working at Grand Canyon when you showed up?
So Ernie had been there from at least the late 60s. I mean, 66, 7, 8 era for sure. I got there, let me backtrack. That's not true. From the late, mid to late 70s. I apologize.
No worries.
Because I didn't get to Grand Canyon until 81.
Okay.
And
so he was there 3 or 4 years before you, something like that?
Well, yeah, he spent 18 years there at the Grand Canyon. And my notes don't specifically say, without me going back and researching it a little bit, specifically when he got there. But I do know that he was there in 1978 for sure.
Okay. All right.
And I think several years before that.
What was his position there when you arrived?
Well, he was a patrol ranger.
Okay.
And, you know, the journeyman level in those days was a GS-9.
Okay.
But Ernie was one of these individuals who was very gifted in many ways. I don't think he graduated from college, but having said that, whatever he decided to do, he would go in with both feet and hook, line, and sinker. And during the during the hippie era, the late middle to so 70s, he really got into being a narc. You know, N-E-R-C, quote unquote narc. Even though he was a patrol ranger. And he had the, of course I'm speaking in generalities, but he had the concession employees there really almost terrified because, you know, they kind of thought he was hiding behind every tree when they'd be out smoking a joint or something. But he really got into sort of a plain clothes / undercover mentality. So he spent a lot of time doing that, but basically he was a patrolman. But in 1978, he became the Park Service's, he used to claim first until I was able to prove him otherwise, but at least the second full certified paramedic in the National Park System.
Oh, wow.
And he went back and did some research for me a number of years ago, and So he was certified on May 10, 1978, which is how I know he was there for sure in 78.
Okay.
And
hey, Butch.
Yes.
I'm going to jump in here because you had done some groundbreaking work in Yosemite on the Park Medic program.
Yeah.
Did the other parks, the other big Western parks, did anybody else outside of California know you were doing this? Because, I mean, I sort of think of that as wow, it was the wave of the future, and you were sparking that up. But here is Kunzel, as you say, here's somebody who's like sitting up trying to pay attention to push first aid forward into emergency medicine.
Well, the first one, as far as I can determine, I've actually made a concerted effort to try to pin this down because I get pretty anal about trying to figure out what's the first.
Good.
Is a guy by the name of Meade Hargis, H-A-R-G-I-S.
What's his first name?
Meade, M-E-A-D.
Okay.
And Meade was a super talented, one of the very first big wall climbers of El Capitan in Yosemite in the late 60s.
Okay.
And I worked with him, I guess, the entire almost 10 years I was in Yosemite. He took me on numerous climbs, was a terribly nice guy. For most of my time there, he was a seasonal.
Okay.
But in those days, it was a long-term seasonal. We would keep him and others on, you know, that had talents like his.
Okay.
For, you know, 7, 8, 9 months. So Meade went to a paramedic school on his off, when he was on, sort of on one of his, you know, several months breaks up in near Stanford. I don't know that it was specifically sponsored by Stanford University, but I think they sort of hosted it anyway.
Okay.
So Meade was the first, and probably not too many months before Ernie. So there were others, you know, a few others out there. You know, paramedics started coming into their forefront a little bit, not so much in the Park Service, but elsewhere. You know, Miami-Dade, Seattle, Denver, Phoenix, and Los Angeles for sure. So Ernie, for whatever reason, got this bug under his bonnet about becoming a paramedic.
Okay.
And he was... he taught EMT, and he was the go-to guy when it came to that sort of thing at the Grand Canyon. Now, Ernie has had a personality, which means I'd like to read like a paragraph or so that I wrote for him.
Okay.
Maybe actually three short ones.
Go ahead, please.
And these were, I wrote these for the Ranger magazine when he died, which he died January 16, 2019.
Okay.
So it's a sort of out of context, but says, the NPS does not lack for unique and colorful people. Ernie was both, and in some circles was near legendary. While the word colorful can mean accomplished, interesting, creative, inquisitive, and enthusiastic, it can also mean irritating, difficult, egotistical, and even insufferable. Ernie was all of the above, and some even considered him a real pain in the ass. Sometimes these traits were exhibited all in the same day. But whatever your take about Ernie, he left little doubt among friend and foe alike that he was passionate about the NPS mission, sincerely believing in the heritage and culture of the Flat Hat. The last paragraph says, throughout his career, there were few that I would more trust my life to in an emergency than Ranger Kunzel. He was a brilliant paramedic. A great many people literally owe their lives to him, including the park's deputy superintendent. I once watched Ernie save a visitor's life in the tiny Grand Canyon Hospital after the local doctor had given up and while a priest was quietly administering the last rites to the patient. And that's all true. So Ernie retired in I have a January 22nd, 1998, but that, I think, is a full-page supplement from the Denver Post about Ernie in the Sunday supplement. So he retired either about that time or not too long after. Well, he says retired January 1998, so okay.
Okay. So I've got a question for you. When you showed up at Grand Canyon, were you EMT certified?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, and then I was this next level, but the next level really at that point didn't have any real significance because I was not in the same jurisdiction anymore. I was not in exclusive jurisdiction, so my capabilities or authorities didn't carry over to Yosemite or to Grand Canyon,
right?
Because of the jurisdictions. I mean, I had advanced training, but Ernie was one of these guys who probably, you know, I might be watching Maude or the Golden Girls. He's working on memorizing, atrial fibrillation charts.
Right. Right.
You know, he's
to read these. He's looking at rhythm strips.
Yes. Right.
while you're watching TV.
Yes, he actually. I mean.
Wow.
I wouldn't have used those words because I forgot about them. But you're 100% correct. He actually ran. When I went down to climb the highest point in South America, Aconcagua, one of the requirements was to bring, and this is way years ago now, the mid '80s. To bring a rhythm strip saying that I was healthy,
okay.
Basically. And there were other requirements. I had to show up and give the authorities these documents. And so Ernie ran a rhythm strip because for some reason either we couldn't do it on me, it wasn't that I was not healthy, it was that somehow it just wasn't convenient. So he ran a rhythm strip on somebody else who was healthy, and he signed it off. and we were just banking on the fact, well, how would these people in Argentina,
right,
or Chile actually really know the difference anyway, right? So Ernie was clever and inquisitive, terribly talented. But he was insufferable all at the times. Sometimes he was a bigot. I directly supervised him from the time that I got there. And Ernie and I established a pretty close friendship and relationship over the 6 years that I was there. He was put on a pedestal in many ways by a lot of the people that went through his first aid and EMT classes. And I guess I'm not sure the certification process for EMT by the state of Arizona at that time, but he was able to sign off and give people cards saying that they've been through whatever, 80 to 100 hour course in EMT. And he was not strictly straight by the book. I mean, he had these guys. I never took one of his classes, but I do know from anecdotal references that he was very creative. It's one of those things where people would be in a classroom setting at the training center, at the Albright Training Center at the South Rim, and all of a sudden somebody would burst in and shoot some blanks at somebody and then leave, and then Ernie would say, okay, everybody, what just happened? I mean, that's the sort of learning that he would often do.
Nice.
He was very, as I say, very creative and passionate's a good word.
Okay,
you're going to ask a question there, so like,
no, I'm you're educating me about Ernie, and I'm like, wow, this is very fascinating.
Well, so
when he would do that, when somebody would run in, step in the room and shoot somebody, would you know, would that person like have a little pouch of ketchup, and then people would have to do like an assessment. Okay, somebody's just been shot here.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was that sort of scenario.
Okay.
You know, specifically like that, I'm not sure, but that's the sort of thing that he was very capable of doing, and often did that sort of thing. He was also a very, very talented climber and mountain rescuer.
Okay.
And he was a climbing ranger in Rocky Mountain, 1963.
Ah, okay.
And he spent 3 years there while he was going to the University of Colorado, which I don't believe he graduated from. Then he spent one year at Devil's Tower.
Okay.
One season. And one season at Carlsbad Caverns. And then he got on as a permanent protection ranger at Coronado National Monument, which is like close to Grand Junction, Colorado. And then 18 years at the Grand Canyon. And when he finished his career, he actually quit and got into a private enterprise. Let me think about this. Yeah, a private enterprise somehow in the medical field there in Flagstaff, and got with a couple of other, you know, nurses and other people around the Flagstaff Hospital. You know, I hate to be, you know, nebulous. I can't think of all the nuances at this very second, but he ended up, after a year or so, not being able to make a go of it. And I know that both J.T. Reynolds and I, he called both of us and asked if we would go to bat for him, because he had reinstatement rights.
Oh.
He just needed to have somebody hire him.
Okay.
You know, in a position. Which he ends up becoming an investigator for the Park Service and stationed at the regional office in our Denver office. So, and that's where he ended up his career.
Okay.
So.
Wow, because that's a big step to leave the service so late in your career, and try something in the private sector, which didn't work, and they had to go back into the service. Wow.
Yeah, you know, if it hadn't been, I mean, you know, many ways I liked Ernie, but there's some things I did not like about him.
Mm.
And he knew it, but he also knew I'd go to bat for him when he needed to have somebody go to bat for him.
Nice, yeah.
And but if he hadn't been so talented, I don't know that, you know, I wouldn't have gone to bat for him that much. One of the things that we did at the Grand Canyon, because, you know, Ernie was certified as a paramedic. There weren't many in the county, for sure. I mean, in Coconino County. And even, I mean, in theory, of course, we had Mojave as well, but I don't know that he ever went to Mojave County for anything. So it was always Coconino. And, you know, we had our fair share of fatalities or people dying in the park and down at the bottom, you know, along the trail and what have you. One instance I recall where, make sure I can get the sequence on this one correctly. We had somebody, this is right at dark, actually, right at dusk, and Ernie and one of the pilots, and I had mentioned Tom Caldwell and Dave Roman before as pilots, and there was another pilot by the name of Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, and that's his last name, who was a younger guy, really a nice guy that ended up living all over the world as a helicopter pilot, last time I heard, in New Guinea.
Wow.
But they flew in on a potential heart case of an older man, which anymore it's hard for me to say that because, you know, he was probably 60.
Mm.
you know, and I'm almost 20 years older than that now. But they go in, and Ernie, through communicating with, you know, the medical control, declared this guy dead. And then he moves the body out of the, you know, then he flies the body out. So there was nothing wrong with that. It's just that, you know, the county, which I can get into here a little bit later perhaps, the county always sort of would bow their back on that sort of thing, even though we had the skill and the resource and the talent, in this case, Ernie, that they did not have, mm-hmm. plus the helicopter, right?
Right.
And, but he moves the body outside the park, and I meet him at the helicopter. You know, it's now dark, you know, with this deceased individual who has been pronounced dead, and he's, there's no question about him having died.
Uh-huh.
But I remember talking to Ernie. I said, Ernie, please, you know, if you get into the situation again, make, if you're going to pronounce somebody dead, do it on top of the rim so that we don't have to worry about any, you know, we can, you know, any problems moving this body from within,
right,
you know, below the rim, and get crosswise with the sheriff, you know, because the sheriff and the county in general were really pains in the rear when it came to that sort of thing, when it came to us, at least. So, you know, and already fully understood. It wasn't like, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, it, had he probably given another 30-second thought to it, or if I'd been on the radio and, you know, which I wasn't going to do on the radio anyway.
Right.
You know, tell him, hey, Ernie, you know, if this guy's dead, don't say anything until you get up to the top. Because, you know, once you're on top, then the sheriff's deputies can come over and say, oh, yeah, this guy's definitely dead, you know, and they can do their coroner
right.
things.
Right.
So I remember that was one instance. One thing that we did do that Ernie can take a lot of credit for is, you know, the Park Service has, in a number of parks now, have these, we used to call them flyaways, but now they're just short hauls, or even long hauls, I guess, where there'll be a rope, generally a rope, occasionally, you know, the helicopter might have a cable, but generally be a rope where we would fly in and take somebody out underneath the helicopter
mm-hmm.
in the stretcher, which, you know, and again, I mean, I have full knowledge in how this all came about because I was right in the middle of this, but the technically it was illegal. Or against policy, not so much illegal, but against policy of the secretary of the Department of the Interior.
Why?
Well, because it was a single engine, and you know, our ships in those days, at least, were single engine, and there was this misguided belief that it was too dangerous. Well, first of all, the pilot, you know, in the park in the Grand Canyon helicopter. If push come to shove, which fortunately it never did for a person anyway, you know, he got his jettison that sling or that stretcher in this case.
Right.
So, you know, generally that person's not tied to the, I mean, that's not, I'm screwing this up. The stretcher is not connected to the wall or the bottom or anything. You know, the pilot has discretion to get rid of it.
Right.
So it wasn't until a number of years later when after I went through the FBI Academy and I went back there for some other, not training, I was helping develop their special response team HEL or APEL program, that I was able to get some real power people to say, yeah, you're right. Butch, in this case, you know, we'll tell the Department of the Interior to go suck an egg.
So
might want
can
to cut
you,
that out. I don't know about
well,
that.
can you open this up for me a little bit, actually?
Yeah.
I'm gonna explore this more because today in 2020 we take short hauls for granted. They are a well used tool that takes river runners off of stranded boats on the Colorado River. That takes people out of remote areas that have broken their hips or legs or somehow damaged themselves to such an extent that they cannot extract themselves. And but the ship can't land
right
near them, and to move that person out of where they are would be a danger to the staff, the protection staff that would move them.
And so, sometimes you didn't have any choice. I mean, it's like this guy's either going to die,
right,
or we're going to fly him out of there.
So I'm sort of wide-eyed and open-jawed, thinking about a time when short hauls were technically illegal. And I'm like, wow, how did the park get around that illegality to use that as a functional tool?
Well, I mean, I should have not used the word illegal. It was against policy.
Okay.
Which for
sorry,
us.
Sorry, thank you.
Is almost illegal. Well, I mean, there were times over the years. I mean, we did it on a couple of occasions in Yosemite, but we had a different kind of a jurisdiction, for one thing.
Yes, yep.
That was one of them. But at the Grand Canyon, in the late 70s, maybe even once or twice before that, and Ernie really couldn't remember, because, again, that goes back to my anal necessity for figuring these things out.
Mm.
But we do know, and even while I was there, there were a couple of occasions when we would do these short hauls where, you know, I mean, we meaning whoever was in charge, and often it was me, and I mean, I have one very definite case where I really irritated the guy that was running the operation until I stepped in and took it over from him. But, you know, because it was a single engine, you know, we didn't have any training, but there was no real training in those days anyway. It was all seat of the pants. It was like the park medic program that I helped develop. You know, we just did what we needed to do. And, you know, oftentimes we were dealing with, you know, not totally bureaucrats, because the guys with the Department of Interior and the Office of Aircraft Services, which is within the Department of the Interior, who oversees aviation and helicopter operations and stuff. You know, those guys are all accomplished pilots and what have you, but they're not the guys on the ground either saying that, you know, if we don't move this guy right now, he's going to die.
Right.
So there's that butting of heads, conceptually at least.
So the aircraft services, is that a part of the FAA?
No, it's part of the Department of the Interior. It's OAS, Office of Aircraft Services, and it's a function of the, but they also have control. I mean, the Department of the Interior, the Secretary of the Interior has given them the mission, position of overseeing aircraft contracts to make sure that, you know, if we're using them for fire flights, or we're using them for fires, or, you know, when I was the aviation manager for the Park Service there, we had roughly 25 collateral duty pilots and about 35 pilots and about 25 planes.
Okay.
So OAS would, you know, ensure that insurances were up to date and certificates were up to date and reviews and checks on engines and the standards of the pilots. All these things were up to snuff.
Okay. Right.
I mean, that's what OAS does. And it's, you know, a little bit, once the camel gets his nose under the tent, of course, it gets you know, it expands its area of responsibility. But in the late 70s at the Grand Canyon, and I wouldn't doubt, you know, one or two other places where you just have these life and death kinds of, you know, scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Grand Tetons, the Rocky Mountains, maybe Yellowstone's kinds of places.
Right.
You know, where the rangers on the field or the people in the field have to make a split-second decision.
Right.
So I don't know if I'm rambling now or not for you, but well, that's the way it was conducted in those days.
You know, in the 6 years that you were at Grand Canyon, was the short haul of people, either visitors or personnel, was that against policy for those entire 6 years?
Yes.
So let's, I would like to take this avenue forward, and could you talk to your role as how you changed that, or how that regulation was changed? Because again, this activity, a short haul activity to hang people off of helicopters, is an integral tool of park operations today.
Yeah.
Training, et cetera. I mean, it's, everybody's trained for it.
Oh yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, okay. So, you know, we did that while I was there. We did it a couple of times early on in my time there, I think. And in 1976, I went through the FBI Academy, the National Academy, which is 3 months long in Quantico, Virginia, which is a fairly prestigious school for mid-level and upper-level law enforcement people, sheriffs, chiefs of police kinds of people. And I was, but the Park Service had one of these, without going into a whole lot of detail, you know, almost an agreement with the FBI that the Park Service, either Park Police and or Rangers, would have somebody at least once a year, and if not twice a year, because they'd have two academies a year. And so going back in time, it's just that the deputy director of the National Park Service, Hillary Tillotson, was brothers with the deputy director of the FBI.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so it's over time that relationship stayed. And even after these guys disappeared from the scene, somehow that, you know, that stayed in place, basically.
So Assistant Director Tolson, his brother was assistant director or deputy director of the FBI,
yeah.
And they got to talking about a relationship between the FBI and the Park Service, and how that could be fostered.
Well, I sort of skipped over. What did you say about right after the deputy director for the FBI?
Was Tolson's brother?
Yeah.
Tolson or Hillary? Tolson, one of the two.
Well, I actually have to double check on that, Tom.
Right, I would too. But because these guys were in these two agencies, and they were clearly good friends and brothers, that started a training relationship between the NPS and the FBI. I think that's really neat.
Yeah. Well, that is true.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Just so you had a chance to go to this academy in 1976.
So I went through the bicentennial year, the summer of 76. So while I was there, I ended up giving a couple of night programs. I got somebody from the Yosemite sent me a bunch of, because I was in Yosemite at the time, and one of the things that we really instituted, and I made a real effort to make sure that we got photos of different rescues in Yosemite. And so I had a whole collection that was sent to me on these big wall rescues and pretty interesting kinds of things that most of these other policemen from New Jersey had never seen before.
Right.
And so I gave a couple of night programs to other classes and classmates and stuff. It had nothing to do with the school itself. It was just something to do on a Tuesday night. So, but in my class, and the guy, I mentioned way back when that I used to swim in the police Olympics. So the guy that was my lifeguard at the academy, because you couldn't swim there by yourself, you know, I'd go and work out. He ends up becoming part of the hostage rescue team, HRT, which is what the FBI has for things like if some ambassador is kidnapped or there's a hostage kind of an incident, you know, like in Atlanta, say, that they take in this HRT team. Well, I got to be pretty good buddies with them. And so a number of years later, about, I have to put this in perspective, figuring out how old my kids were. So,
okay,
like maybe about 79, I'm asked to go back to spend a week with some pretty heavy hitters from my perspective. The deputy chief, let me think about this, the deputy chief for...
Hey, Butch.
Yes.
I'm going to jump right in here. Okay. Something's happening with the phone line, like it wants to disconnect. So if you're doing something on your end, I want you to think about it, because I know we had the phone disconnect a couple of interviews back.
Yeah. No, I'm not touching it.
Okay. Well, it's funny, because something's going on here. I can hear the line clicking.
Well, I hear a click once in a while.
Yeah. And I'm like, why is it doing that? Well, we're going to keep going.
Okay.
So in 1979, they sent you back to Washington, D.C., is that right?
Well, yeah, Quantico, Virginia, which is basically Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And I've got my two young sons and my wife. My wife had never been to either New York City, which we took in while we were there.
Okay.
And then she stays with a girlfriend, and I go down to Quantico for a week, and I'm part of a group that is to design the helicopter response program for this rescue team, this HRT team. And my expertise in this case is really sort of the search and rescue angle, the vertical, the cliffs, how to, rappel out a helicopter kinds of things. That was the expertise I'm bringing. But as I was starting to say, I think that, the deputy chief of the Los Angeles County Fire Department was there, who I got to be really good friends with. And I'm sort of making this up, but I'll just to give you some level, the chief pilot for, say, the Maryland Highway Patrol, the chief pilot for the California Highway Patrol, about four or five of these guys, the chief pilot for, I think it was the Tucson Police Department, was just getting a helicopter in those days. So there were about seven or eight of these guys, and then Russ Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, was my only other search and rescue counterpart, and he had been with one of the big search and rescue units, civilian units, out of the Los Angeles Basin.
Okay.
But he also went on and designed a bunch of carabiners and different things that they still use today, although he sold his business.
Hmm.
So anyway, there's a group of about, I don't know, maybe a dozen of us, and we'd sit around this big table and we'd design this program for the FBI. So at the very end, we present the product to whoever we needed to present it to. And at the very end, there was, an hour or two. And, of course, during the week, I got to know most of these guys, not everyone very well, but a lot of them, several, pretty well. So I posed this problem to these guys. I said, I would like to take, half an hour, 45 minutes of your time. Here's my dilemma. And, I stood up in front of the group or something, and I said, we have these vertical rescues in remote areas, et cetera. I laid it on thick. Of course, they knew. I'm sure I gave some slide programs talking about all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, but my policy that I am supposed to adhere to is that we can't do these because of the nature of the helicopters that we almost all have. In those days, they're all single engine. And a lot of what these guys were flying were single engines, but they're all high time pilots. And collectively, and I made this, I can't remember the estimate anymore, but I, one time in presenting a paper about this, I came up with something like, 40 or 50,000 hours of helicopter time among all these guys. One or two of them had been in Vietnam. So there was a lot of juice there. There was a lot of expertise that I would never have access to again.
Right.
So I said, here's the dilemma. I want to be able to do this on rare occasions. I don't want to do it all the time. I don't want to abuse it. I just would like to have somebody, some entity, some group approving or at least acknowledging the necessity to do this. And I said, so what do you guys think? How is this about, so they went and, within 15 minutes or less, they lost me because they got into a lot of very technical, not scenarios as much as analyses of, what a helicopter can do under certain conditions and if that one motor stops, how far can they glide and what's going to happen. And, they went through it pretty intensely. And as I say, I quickly lost a lot of their, I didn't know what they were talking about half the time.
Okay.
But at the end of the time, the consensus was, there's absolutely no risk. I mean, the risk is so minimal statistically between it being needed, between the time, the helicopter engine quitting, being at the wrong place at the wrong time, all that sort of thing, that it's infinitesimal. So I said, okay, thank you guys. And so I go back and, I'm at the Grand Canyon early on, and I'm, because of my aviation position, overseeing aviation and the helicopter at the Grand Canyon, I'm starting a relationship with the Office of Aircraft Services and some of the people there. So, I go to them. I mean, it wasn't like I waited for them to say something. I went to them and said, here's the deal, guys. We need this latitude officially. Having been in the field, having seen this necessity play out in real life, having violated the policy, knowing that you needed to, I was conducting myself professionally with these sorts of things, knowing that, this red face test where Walter Cronkite puts a microphone in my face, if something were to happen, I know that maybe I'm going to be liable, that maybe I'm going to be out and, hung out to dry. But I also know that perhaps the right thing to do is to try to save this person's life or to do this or whatever. And that's the way I try to conduct business. And so when, dealing with OAS, who we got along pretty well as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And, I oversaw the, I think it was the Park Services, except for the Park Police. I think it was the Park Services at that time, at least, the only full-time helicopter program in the park system. I can't think of any place else. Maybe Big Cypress, not Big Cypress, but there's a park in, not Everglades, but a place in Florida. But mostly it was the only operation in town, and so I had a, I was a kind of a big player for them in a small way. So the relationship was pretty good, but, you know, I was trying to make a case for helping the Rangers in the field, which is what I thought my job was, to try to make life easier and safer and more efficient and cheaper and all that stuff for them.
And this is 1987, is that right?
So, well, I went to D.C. as a, you know, as the emergency services coordinator in 87, but I was making a play with OAS long before that.
Okay, so this took some time.
It didn't happen. You know, I didn't ball them out one week, and the next week they're giving me permission.
Okay.
You know, I know that it, I went to the FBI Academy in 76. I went back there in 79, I believe, roughly at least, to work on this task force for a week for their FBI, the FBI's hostage rescue team.
Right.
Met all these guys, or you know, developed this 50,000-hour flying time concept at the end of that week. Took that memory with me back, moved on to the Grand Canyon, had a couple of short haul incidents there, you know, it started registering on me that we need to have something that helps us work this in the field. And, you know, once in a while, I'm sure that other parks and maybe even Grand Canyon, we would violate that. But, you know, we still adhere to whatever the OAS was telling us to do. And, but finally, I guess it was just enough's enough. We got to tackle this head on. So I did.
And how did you do that? How did you tackle it head on then?
I challenged the guys at OAS that were my liaison, and I got to know them because of the, even though I had a fixed wing in the summertime, I had a helicopter 24/7. So I worked with one or two of these people, these men, you know, on a pretty regular basis. So, I mean, when I say head on, I mean, it's just that I would pick up the phone and we'd have these discussions and say, well, how about, so put us something on paper and, you know, give us some examples and propose this and whatever.
Okay.
Justify it. And, that, you know, I would do that and we'd go back and forth and there's all the bureaucracy in between.
Right.
And I know that before I left and went to Washington, D.C., you know, I had at least a verbal permission from them to do what you need to do, just don't kill anybody and maybe don't tell us. You know,
yeah, but that's not good enough. And,
well,
yeah.
It might have been the way it was. But.
Well, so then how did you finally get it on paper?
Well, then when I got to D.C., you know, part of my portfolio was I oversaw search and rescue, EMS,
right.
Diving, health and fitness, the incident command system, and aviation.
So this was a back to D.C. in 97, having been working this issue for at least 10 years.
No, I was in D.C. in 87.
Sorry, 87. Thank you.
Well, you know, I don't think the stuff hit the fan really between them and myself until the, you know, 84, 85, 86 era.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't like there was a big time in between there. There was some time between, you know, one or two minor short hauls in Yosemite, a couple, three or four, perhaps in Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And then, you know, but I was still at the Grand Canyon when I got this verbal agreement. Then I went to D.C. and ended up writing 90-95% of the aviation policy, the directives for the agency, which included, you know, these exceptions, these variances, like maybe a wetsuit and high altitude gear is fine if you have to. And, you know, if you have to do the short haul and you got only a single engine, then that's where it is.
Oh, this is really good. So you had a chance to write the directives and include in some variances, which is a really nice word,
yeah.
to allow short hauls, and also you mentioned wetsuits and high altitude gear, where the regulation was you had to wear the Nomex fireproof clothing at all.
Well, that was the SOP.
Okay.
You know, but and you know we adhere to that most of the time. Sure.
Uh huh. But occasionally there would be some variations for
that's right
for specific reasons.
That's exactly right. And
okay,
I don't know. You know, maybe the people today, you know, are more concerned about the liabilities and the litigious aspects of all this, but I wasn't. I was concerned about taking care of the Rangers.
Well, on the contrary, Butch, because what I think of today with short haul, and you can see this on the internet quite a bit, is not only is there a helicopter short hauling a visitor litter in a basket, but there's a Ranger connected to them as well.
That's because they've got the policy approves it now.
Yes. So
the policy didn't approve it then.
So I look at your work as being groundbreaking to get to where we are today.
Well, I think that's correct.
Which is pretty neat.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't thought about it really too much. I guess.
You know, instead of going off into the litigation of today, going off into how a clearly needed tool is continuing to get better. And you guys saw it. You used it. And then the next thing you need to do was get a variance to do it. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, you know, it's written in that you don't do this every day, and it's not something that, but there is, you know, there's always an exception to the rule.
Okay.
And that's what I was dealing with, was to cover the exceptions to the rule. You know, let's put this out in front of everybody and let people know that there are exceptions to the rule.
Nice. Excellent. You know, this might be a great place to wrap up this Part 13 interview, and next time we'll go back and talk a little bit more about Ernie Kunzel and maybe some of the short-haul activities that you did have. And with that, that'll conclude Part 13, Oral History Interview with Butch Farabee. Today is June 28, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Butch, thank you so very much.